Welcome to China Insider, a podcast from the Hudson Institute's China Center. I'm Miles Yu, Senior Fellow and Director of the China Center. Join me each week for our analysis of the major events concerning China, China threat, and their implications to the U.S. and beyond.
It's Tuesday, November 11th, and we have three topics this week. First, we cover NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang's recent visit to Beijing and the larger impact of NVIDIA and other companies in the AI race between the U.S. and China. Next, we take a look at China's latest aircraft carrier to enter service, the CNS Fujian, and the impact this might have on China's naval warfare capabilities. Lastly, we review Taiwan Vice President Xiaobi Kim's unprecedented address in Brussels at the IPAC plenary session in the European Parliament and unpack the larger meaning and impact behind her speech. Miles, great to be with you again this week.
Nice to be with you again.
So up first today, we got NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang visited Beijing last Thursday, a day after the U.S. government announced an investigation into the company and whether it violated export control and other trade rules with sales to China. So during his visit, Huang met with several Chinese economic policy and trade officials as part of the China Council for Promotion of International Trade. And leading up to the visit, NVIDIA promised early last week, actually, to start the timeline here, a $500 billion investment in AI infrastructure to the U.S., which a day later raised concerns over licensing restrictions for sales to China and eventually prompted the House Select Committee on the CCP to open the investigation here. So, Miles, a lot of dominoes in the span of only a few days. Can you walk us through what's been going on with NVIDIA currently and what Jensen Huang is intending to do with his trip to China?
Jensen Huang is a not ordinary individual. He is the head of the world's largest company, NVIDIA, which has a capitalization of over $5 trillion. That is a gigantic behemoth. So number one. Number two, he is also a individual who has been in this graphic cards, the GPU business for a long, long, long time. So he has a very extensive connection and investment partners inside China. And also he's from Taiwan. And I think, he has a lot of connection in Taiwan as well. So Taiwan is the place where the most advanced chip making is happening. So Jensen Huang is the nexus of the leading technology that really decides the future of our contemporary life. So he's very important. So Mr. Huang is also a man of enigma. I mean, he's a technical titan, a technology titan, but also he has a very peculiar, if not naive, politics. So he goes to Taiwan, he goes to China, and everything that goes to China, it has intrinsically the national security concern involved. So this is basically what your prelude indicated. And we're going to probably use this time to dissect some of the nuanced details.
Yeah, and so while there are many companies at various stages of the supply chain involved in the AI race between the U.S. and China, advanced software and chip manufacturers are typically under the brightest spotlight, and NVIDIA is perhaps the most valuable of these companies. So our listeners might remember back 3 years ago, following the initial wave of export controls to restrict Chinese chip procurement, NVIDIA intentionally lowered the capacity of one of its chips, the H20, to meet threshold requirements and became a Chinese-specific product. So since then, Jensen Huang has insisted on China's essential role in the AI market globally and has gone as far as to suggest that China is actually ahead in the current AI race. So Miles, I'd love to get your assessment here on what the current AI market landscape is and who holds the current advantage between the U.S. and China.
Oh, definitely the United States is holding the advantage. Jensen Huang's remarks about the AI technology in China and in the U.S. has been very conflicting. I mean, one day he said China is not a second behind, and then another day he said, oh, we are 5 and 10 years ahead of China. So it's very interesting. I think this is actually a fundamental problem. The problem that Mr. Huang is conflicted with is the problem of the dilemma of corporate interest versus national interest. For, to him, there's no difference. I mean, this is very troubling because about a week ago, he was asked, you know, in the AI race, doesn't matter if China wins or US wins. He said, no, it doesn't matter. This is a really, really naive and a myopic view because if China wins the AI, there would be no NVIDIA pretty soon. So this is it matters mightily. And I think Mr. Huang's also, ever since he's been talking about this kind of a sense of China's tremendous advancement in AI technology, and this the subtext is that China is so advanced, it would be futile for the United States to conduct export control. In other words, you know, whatever, you know, NVIDIA is making in Silicon Valley in the United States, we should just ship it to China and occupy the markets. This is very dangerous. Export control is a matter of national security. It's absolutely vital. And so I don't know exactly where Mr. Huang stands on this. On the surface, he said, of course, you know, we want to go there because it's futile to actually to stop China from advancing because they're unstoppable. This is a very dangerous thought. And I think, you know, there's no question China has made a tremendous advancement in AI technology. But Mr. Huang and NVIDIA themselves are major culprit for China's AI rise. I mean, think about this. Mr. Huang has a lieutenant. For 14 years, he was the vice president of NVIDIA in Silicon Valley. His name is Zhang Jianzhong. And his English name is James Zhang. So in 2020, after 14 years serving as Mr. Huang's vice president in Silicon Valley, Mr. Zhang just left the United States and went to China. They're setting up a sort of a competitor and the very powerful AI firms called More Threats. Now, More Threats is basically competing with NVIDIA and now is surpassing NVIDIA in some aspects. So I think Mr. Huang is really haunted by the ghost of his own Frankenstein. That's the More Threats in China. And there's been a report that NVIDIA's China office shared the same address with the More Threats of NVIDIA's Frankenstein. So I think this is a very, very troubling. So I'm not surprised the Congress, the China Committee, is actually investigating the ties between NVIDIA and More Threats because it is really not about export control. It's more about sort of a sanction and more about national security. I think this is a very important message. And I also think that the idea that China is unstoppable in AI race is just, baloney. It's a same kind of a rhetoric coming from the mouth of the Chinese propaganda machine. That is, the CPP is unstoppable. China is unstoppable. It's nothing but capitulationism, and you know, and I think that Mr. Huang may unwittingly, I emphasize unwittingly, parrot the line of Chinese propaganda. So, because I think Mr. Huang failed to understand fundamentally the structural flaws of China's AI ecosystem, eco environment. So you cannot say, you know, if NVIDIA and many of the other Silicon Valleys, including Apple, behave and put in national interest ahead of their own corporate interest, China will be miles ahead behind the United States, not nanoseconds behind us.
Yeah, that's certainly a concerning development. Do you have any idea, Miles, as whether, you know, NVIDIA has kind of been the spotlight here over the last week for obvious reasons and developments, but, you know, there are many other companies involved in the supply chain, like we mentioned. I think, you know, AMD and their CEO, Lisa Su, and other companies. It's like, is NVIDIA kind of alone in the concerns here, or are there other companies that should be of concern for the U.S. government right now?
Well, because of NVIDIA's leading prominence in Silicon Valley, Mr. Huang is a chief lobbyist to the White House to ease, even cancel, Americans' export control to China, particularly his own chips. This is very dangerous. This is extremely dangerous. And then Mr. Huang even has gone so far to call the so-called the China hawks, which really do not exist, because everybody who's dealing with China now is considered as hawk because of the Chinese reality. The threat is really, really important. So, and he called them unpatriotic. I mean, this is just just ridiculous. And I think Mr. Huang is motivated by NVIDIA's desire to march into Chinese market through cooperation with its own creation, the more threats and a lot of Chinese companies. This is corporate sort of a globalism, which is very dangerous to the national security of the United States. And I think, you know, I mentioned earlier, we have to understand the CCP is not unstoppable. The CCP has some very structural limitations, particularly when it comes to AI race. Think about this. Look at the rise and the rapid fall of DeepSeek, China's answer to OpenAI and ChatGPT, because the Chinese political culture, technological culture, does not tolerate truth and transparency. And artificial intelligence is primarily relying on big data. China collects an enormous amount of data, but also Chinese government is the most notorious distorter of data. So for political purposes, they just can really distort, misinterpret all the data. And that's why DeepSeek has no future. DeepSeek came to the world with great fanfare, and everybody was scared. But now, I mean, is very few people use it. I mean, it's rendered completely useless for most of the the customers outside of China. So, and another thing is we have to understand that China dominates artificial intelligence, at least they try to dominate the artificial intelligence and other technologies in order to sell their products to the world in a very monopolistic way. If there is an alternative to Western products, such as NVIDIA's own products, then China will be severely contained. Just look at China's electric vehicles. China's electric vehicles were heavily subsidized by the government. That's why it's very cheap, and technologically it's very advanced, but it occupies a very small share of global markets because every major country, including EU, the trading bloc, is prohibiting Chinese-made EUs from entering their markets. That's why EU occupy less than 10% of global EU EV market. So that is the telling. So if we band together to realize the particular danger of a Chinese model of technological development, and then NVIDIA will shine. So I don't know why this is so hard to see.
Yeah, let's stick with those policy analysis and recommendations here to round out the topic, because, you know, from the perspective of the U.S. government and the international community and, you know, allies in the international community, what can we do to maintain the current disparities in the AI race? You know, in your assessment, Miles, are current export controls effective in curbing Chinese production? And what other channels of leverage are left to explore here?
Oh, export control is crucial. I mean, China obviously has made an economic stride and technological stride. There's no question about that. But that development in China is critically dependent upon Western innovation and technology. That's why one of the most important tools the U.S. government and U.S. society as a whole have against the Chinese threat is really through export control. We did that very, very effectively during the Cold War, but that's because we have a collective mechanism to conduct export control to Eastern Bloc collectively. No country, no company could get away with doing something sort of hanky-panky with the Soviets, with its Eastern communist regimes. So that's one reason why it's effective. So now, United States is leading the way to conduct export control for its own national security. And I think a lot of companies, a lot of other countries try to make an exception. That exception those exceptions have harmed American national security very, very greatly. I mean, just look at this idea about tariffs. I mean, the United States levy heavy tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum because China is dumping all over the world, particularly the United States, destroying Americans' steel and aluminum industry. So since Obama years, and we levy heavy, heavy tariffs on China's steel and aluminum. But then there's a lot of friendly countries, Australia, France, England, you know, they all come to the United States asking for exemptions. We did that in 2018 under the first term of the Trump administration. That was a mistake. That's why at the beginning, very beginning of the second term of the Trump administration, we sealed that. We get rid of all the exemptions. Everybody, every country that does China's bidding through transshipping of Chinese steel and aluminum to the United States will be get rid of, will be without their exemptions. And that's basically what's fair.
Turning to our next topic today, we cover the latest news from the PLA Navy as the new CNS Fujian aircraft carrier entered service last Wednesday, actually, in a ceremony that was attended by Xi Jinping. The carrier boasts several advanced capabilities that stand to boost planned blue water capabilities and advanced surface warfare capacities. So, Miles, what should we know to start us off here? What should we know about the CNS Fujian, and why does this new vessel matter to plan maritime strategy?
Well, as you say, I mean, this is China's way to tell the world that China is ready for the Blue Water Navy to contest the power of the U.S. Navy, which is number one in the world. I look at this whole process. If you understand any of the ethos and motivations of China's weapons development, which is heavily influenced by political ideology, which is to buttress the CCP's sense of infallibility and invincibility. So the party, for its own existence, needs constant reassurance of triumphs and great achievements. Carrier fleet is one of the most tangible, conspicuous symbol of power and power projection. So if you look at this, you look at China's carrier development, it fits into this political culture perfectly. So if you look at the first Chinese carrier, which is the CNS Liaoning, gave China a big power status. But you know, they did it despite China's backward naval architecture and ship designs. And China want to push ahead to indicate how powerful, how invincible the party is. So you know the Liaoning story. I mean, 1999, China bought the Soviet design, half-finished, a shell of this carrier called the Varyag, which was then in Ukraine. So China spent $20 million and used a phony company in Hong Kong. And then they spent several times more on transit and docking. And then about 10 years later, China retrofit and made it barely float with the limited sea trials and without an operational air wing even. So they rushed to claim victory and launch it in September 2012. Why September 2012? Because that's just about the time Hu Jintao, the former party chief of China, Xi Jinping's predecessor, was about to end his tenure. So in order to glorify Hu Jintao and his CMC, Central Military Commission chairmanship, so launched that just weeks before he handed over to Xi Jinping. And so and Xi Jinping took over, and the first thing he did was, I'm going to develop more air carriers. So Xi Jinping and Navy people told him, you know what, to match the United States of carrier power, you got to do more. One of the most advanced features that U.S. carrier fleet has is this thing called the electric magnetic catapult, which then was been developed through the USSR, JR-4. So Xi Jinping said, let's do it. And he had no idea what it involved. So this is a political decision. He wanted to do it regardless, just show how powerful, how awesome the party and himself would be. So, and you look at this. The new ship, China, the third carrier, is called the Fujian. Why Fujian? Because that's where Xi Jinping's power base was. He was a Fujian party chief there. Most of the people he used in his current regime have Fujian connections. So this is very much like all Communist Party leaders. You know, in the Soviet years, you got Khrushchev. Nikita Khrushchev, his power base is Ukraine because he was a longtime party chief in Ukraine. So it's very much like Fujian's like a Khrushchev's Ukraine. So Xi Jinping himself decided on electromagnetic catapult, a technology only the U.S. can handle. And it's still not really completely mature yet for the United States even. So that's one reason you saw President Trump was on the carrier in Tokyo Bay last month, and he watched the launch of the aircraft from the deck of the carrier through this steam-operated catapult. He said, "Oh, I like the steam power; it's very much more reliable." So even United States has some difficulties with that. China yet wants to go ahead because this is a symbol of China's technological advancement. So it's not a work of greatly forward mentality, if you know the history of Chinese Communist Party. It was launched in a hurry. It was a rushed job last week. Most obvious one is it's conventionally powered. It's not nuclear powered. You know, if you use an electromagnetic catapult, it's going to consume enormous amount of electricity for its constant launch frequency. And, you know, conventionally powered propulsion it's hard to have sufficient power to sustain the huge demand for electricity on the ship as big as Fujian. Fujian is about 80,000 tons of displacement. I mean, it's far short of the 11 operational U.S. nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. I mean, the Nimitz-class carrier, any one of our Navy carrier fleet would definitely beat the Fujian by a long shot. So my overall take about Fujian is that there's a lot of technical glitches that have not solved. They do not have a very good carrier-ready aircraft, air wing. So because Chinese aircraft, basically the J-15 and J-35, they're kind of chunky and very unimpressive to me. So overall, my take about Fujian is it's operation-ready, not quite combat ready yet. I might want to add one more thing. It's very interesting. Excuse me. The launch ceremony is also very peculiar. You know, this whole thing was basically marks the gigantic triumph of China's carrier technology as promoted by the Chinese state media, particularly the gung-ho xenophobic Global Times. So, but it's Xi Jinping himself. You know, who were absent at this launch ceremony? Now, this ship's home port is in Sanya, is in Hainan Island. It's under the command of South Fleet of Chinese Navy. You know who were absent at the ceremony? It's the Chinese Navy chief. He's not there. And also absent was the commander of South Fleet, as well as the commissar of South Fleet. They're all absent. So this is very peculiar. So I would not be surprised. This would definitely indicate another round of purges, including those guys, Navy chief, commander of South Fleet, because after all, you know, many of the similar counterparts in other theater commands were also being purged just last month.
Yeah, that's right. And there's going to be a few more probably on the way in the future months here. But it seems, just to sum up everything here, a very comprehensive analysis, it seems the biggest development has been the electromagnetic launch system, which compared to the predecessors, like you mentioned, the CNS Shandong and the Liaoning carriers, which have ski jump runways, which for our listeners it looks exactly as it sounds. It's a curving upward end of the launch pad to launch the aircraft. But the significance of this is that it allows the flagship carrier now for the PLA Navy to store fixed wing aircraft and enhance operational capacities in blue water vessel capacities. But ultimately, it sounds like is not going to alter the calculus on the U.S. perspective for Indo-Pacific deterrence strategies. But I guess the one question, Miles, to round out this topic that I'm sure a few folks are kind of wondering here, whether or not is China already building a fourth carrier to add to the fleet? And the big question on people's minds here, what is the chance the next carrier for the PLA Navy will be nuclear powered?
Well, you know, I hope China will spend a lot more money building their own fleet because they have miles to go to catch the lethality and operational effectiveness of the U.S. carrier fleet. We've been doing this for a long time at a great expense. And we're very careful. Each carrier, when it's built, it takes years and a lot of money and also go through rigorous sea trials and before it was delivered into service. So I don't think China has that kind of a political culture. And technologically, yeah, they're behind. Just talking about the carrier fleet. And, carrier fleet is the fundamental tool of power projection. That's why nuclear propulsion is very important. You can go for 20, 25 years without refueling. If you have a conventionally powered carrier, and if you do not have a system of a network of overseas provision station, basing station, you know, repair system, like the U.S. always do globally, and the carrier basically maintain nothing but a literal vessel. You're just sailing around China's coastal area and for promotional purposes. By the way, China has three carriers so far. I think at least two of them are just training ships, training vessels. They're not really operationally super effective. Do they have the capability to launch and retrieve? I think they do. But when you compare that kind of capability with the Americans, with the vast experience of our carrier development, I think China has a way to go. I mean, so this is something that we can be very, very, very sure of. Does China have a surprise? Yes, China always surprises us. But our job is to see how impressive and how defective, how limited their weapon developments are. And all signs indicated that they have made tremendous progress from a very low point of view. But they still have a way to go.
That would certainly track. So turning to our final topic for today, Taiwan Vice President Zhao Bikim delivered an unprecedented address at the Interparliamentary Alliance on China's annual summit, or IPAC, in the EU Parliament. The unprecedented qualification is due to this being the first ever address delivered by a senior official of Taiwan's government in the EU legislature, which has never happened in a country, much less an international forum, that does not officially hold diplomatic relations with Taiwan. So, Miles, the nature of the address wasn't the only significant matter. What did the vice president cover in her speech, and what are the key takeaways we should know from this event?
Well, the messages have been familiar to many in the world about Taiwan. And Bikim Zhao is the vice president. She speaks perfect English, and she was, as a matter of fact, the Taiwanese ambassador. Ambassador or equivalent to the United States when I was working for the State Department. So I knew her very well. And I think, you know, what she said was that Taiwan is not alone. Taiwan has friends. What Taiwan stands for is not just some kind of parochial issue in Western Pacific. What Taiwan stands for is global peace and a global model of governance, championing for democracy and freedom. So that's all the familiar faces. So as you indicated correctly, it's not what she said that mattered the most. It's the fact that she was able to go to Brussels and standing in the hollow halls of the European lawmakers. And that is really important because the Chinese government was furious with this. They threatened the EU diplomats and the EU parliament. But then those people were not really, did not bow down, shall we say. And I think the Chinese diplomacy is basically wolf warrior diplomacy, full of a lot of insults and threats. And I think it's a sign of desperation. Taiwan is getting more and more recognized by the international community, particularly the Alliance of Democracies. Most people really look at the Taiwan-China spat not as an issue of a territorial dispute, who owns home, who belongs to whom, whether Taiwan is a province or not. Rather, they have a look at the Taiwan issue almost entirely from the point of view of tyranny versus freedom, dictatorship versus democracy. And I think that's a very correct perspective. This is a very important thing. And also sends a very strong signal to China that Taiwan indeed is not isolated. China always try to pin the blame for Taiwanese desire for self-determination, self-governance on the United States. So we're the black hands, or we're the instigator for Taiwan independence. All of this is nonsense. They just do not really understand the Taiwanese people's own feelings and their desire for popular sovereignty. And this one, actually, the big blow to China from Taiwan was not really rendered from Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles or San Francisco, rather from Brussels, from the heart of the European continent. So, and that's why it's very important to stress the symbolism of Taiwan being sort of supported not only by the Americans, but also by Europeans.
Yeah, one of those key elements in her address is something that has been a Taiwan government talking point for quite some time now. But it's, you know, like you mentioned, it's not about the juxtaposition of Taiwan in reference to China and the quest for self-determination. It's really that Taiwan is a vital component of global prosperity and an advocate for democracy worldwide, not just in the face of the communist China threatening to invade. They really stand to provide a much greater benefit to the global community as an active contributor. So, Miles, what is the significance of this speech in the context of Taiwan's status in the international community? Because historically, there have been several occasions of including Taiwan in certain international forums and events, sometimes to provoke China or act as a counter to coercive developments from the mainland. So, in reference to this event, might this lead to more official relations between the EU and Taiwan, or are there still significant structural barriers to a more robust relationship between the two?
I think, you know, philosophically and intellectually, even ideologically, Taiwan is already recognized by the world democracies. What we need is formality. Now, that is basically the matter of political courage. And I think there's only a few senior Western leaders are willing and courageous enough to say the obvious, that is, we have to diplomatically recognize Taiwan. Now, the China always tried to phrase this issue of Taiwan and China from the point of view of reunification. That is just a total, total garbage, because Taiwan has never been part of the People's Republic of China. That's just undeniable fact. Since 1949, not one inch of Taiwan's territory has ever been governed and administered by Chinese government. Secondly, Taiwan's sovereignty has nothing to do with really the KMT struggle and the former Republic of China fled to Taiwan. But Taiwan's sovereignty and a sense of independence really came from its time when it started the democracy and freedom in late 1980s, and particularly since the first democratic election in 1995, 1996. So, and by the way, China always say Taiwan historically belonged to China. That is also kind of, you know, gobbledygook, because international law never recognized the legitimacy of historical rights as justification for annexation and territorial demand. So, I mean, most obvious case is the 2016, the Hague sort of tribunal ruling against China's claim in the South China Sea, and ruling saying that China's demand and claim for the South China Sea is completely illegal. Of course, you know, I think China wants to have Taiwan because China wants to finish what they call the unfinished revolution of liberation of 1949. When the Chinese Communist Party was so triumphant, they basically defeated the nationalist government. And the only thing they could not really do, they has not done, is to completely subjugate the group of people who fled to Taiwan. So Taiwan is part of is an intrinsic part of Chinese Communist Party's ideology of liberation. So this is very, very important for us to keep in mind. So most importantly, the U.S. government has never acknowledged and agree to China's claim that Taiwan is a part of China. You can go through all the three communiques, the six assurances, Taiwan Relations Act, all the documents you see that United States just merely acknowledged China is claiming Taiwan as part of it. We never said we agree with you or not agree with you. All we said is that this matter has to be settled by both sides of the people along the Taiwan Strait. Taiwanese have to agree to China's claim. And this is our this is our bottom line, right? Another thing, of course, we absolutely oppose to any resort to use of force to settle this problem. So that's why United States does not recognize Taiwan as part of China. So this has to be made clear.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave off for this week's conversation. Thank you to our listeners for joining us again this week. And thank you, Miles, as always, for lending us your expert insight and analysis on these critical issues. Looking forward to next week's discussion.
All right. I can't wait.